basic Bible prophecy. You know, Revelation 19:10, the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. About a fourth of the Bible is prophecy. Prophecy is one thing that sets the Bible apart from all other religious books, because no other religious books can predict the future with 100% accuracy like the Bible does. Books are $10, and that money goes back to our ministry. And then on the right part of the table, you see these magazines. These are as a gospel, like a gospel tract you can share with someone who's not a believer. And then right below that, you'll see a sign-up sheet. If you would like to sign up to receive our monthly newsletter, just put your name and address on there. If you would like to receive my email blast that goes out almost every week, just put your email on there, and be glad to send that out to you. Well, last time, you know, we talked about the attack that took place in Israel, October 7th. It's been over a year now, 1 year anniversary since Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th. And they're calling it the greatest attack on the Jewish people since the Holocaust. And since that time, there has been a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism spiking all around the world, even here in America. I was just down in Chicago a few weeks ago and walking down Michigan Avenue, and I hear somebody talking on this loudspeaker, and I get down there, and sure enough, it's an anti-Israel protest. And it's just shocking to see that here in America. But my friends, this is what we would expect for the end times. And in our message this morning, I want to show you that there's a battle, you know, there's a battle going on behind the scenes that we can't see, right? And it's a battle between God and Satan. Remember, was it Elisha? The armies came, Elisha's up on this mountain, and the armies had surrounded him and wanted to take him captive. And Elisha's servant says to him, Elisha, we're surrounded, what should we do? And what does Elisha say to him? He says, Lord, open his eyes. And as his eyes were opened, what did he see? Chariots and horses of fire, angelic beings surrounding them and protecting them. And we could go on all kinds of stories about that, but there's this battle that's going on behind the scenes between God and Satan. And I want to show you this morning how really Israel is very key to that battle. So what we got to do is go back to the very beginning. So if I go to our first slide, and when I say beginning, I'm talking about even before Adam and Eve. let's look at Ezekiel chapter 28. If we go to our first slide, and why have the Jewish people been the most persecuted people, really in the history of the world? Not only in the last 2,000 years, but in the history of the world. I remember taking a class on Jewish history in Bible college, and I remember going into the class and thinking, "Oh, wow, this gonna be great. We're gonna learn all the wonderful things Jewish people have done and accomplished, and they have done a great number of them." But what I found, a lot of the class was just about how Israel and the Jewish people have been persecuted, and they go to one country and they're live there for a while, persecuted. They go to another country, live persecuted, go to another country, and. We could talk about, the Crusades, the Inquisitions, the pogroms, World War II. Think about this. The greatest war in our history to this date, a lot of it was fought because of one man, Adolf Hitler's hatred of the Jewish people. And did you know that the United Nations has passed more resolutions condemning Israel than against all of the other nations in the world combined? And it really makes no sense until we understand that there is a battle going on behind the scenes between God and Satan, and Israel is very key to that. So we go to our next slide, and we're looking at Ezekiel chapter 28, and pick it up verse 12. Son of man, took up a lamentation upon the king of Tyre, and say to him, thus saith the Lord God, you seal up the sum full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. You have been in Eden, the Garden of God. Now, in the first 10 verses of this chapter, Ezekiel is, and God is talking about the earthly king of Tyre. But now he turns his attention to the spiritual being who's behind that earthly king. And he says of this being that he filled up the sum. In other words, he was the highest created being. And then he says in verse 13 that he was in Eden, the garden of God. Now, we know this has to be talking about Satan, because Satan is the only one, is the serpent, who was in Eden, the garden of God. We know that that serpent was Satan, because we see that in Revelation chapter 20, at the as Jesus is about to rule, returns to the earth and is going to rule and reign. It says an angel took hold of that serpent who is Satan. And so the serpent, here he was in the Garden of Eden. So this is talking, and this chapter is talking about Satan and his fall. And I also have up there Isaiah 14, which we're not going to look at, but Isaiah 14 tells us that Satan fell because of his pride. And then he says in verse 13, Ezekiel 28, 13, every precious stone was your covering, sardis, topaz, diamond, beryl, onyx, jasper, etc. And many of these stones are the same stones that were used on the breastplate of the high priest. Remember when God brought Israel out and they built the tabernacle and you had the high priest. There were many priests, but only one high priest. And that high priest wore a breastplate with 12 different stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel. And here we see that the very similar stones that were worn by Satan, this is before his fall. And he says, your flutes were prepared in you in the day you were created. Now, he cannot be talking about a human being here, because we're born, but this being was created. Then verse 14, he says, you are the anointed cherub that covers. Now, in the Bible, we learn that there are three classes of angels. All right, and in the book of Revelation, we learn that there are billions, literally billions and billions of angels that were created. And I like to call them like, your average white-collar angels, okay? But then there were also seraphim. We see seraphim are created. Seraphim have six winged angels, but then a cherub here. Here we find out that Satan, before he fell, was a cherub. And he was the highest created being. And he says that he was anointed. And that's the Hebrew word Mashiach. And there were three different groups of people in the Old Testament that were called anointed. Prophets, priests, and kings. Before they did their ministry, they were anointed with oil. And that is the Hebrew word Mashiach, where we get the word Messiah. It means an anointed one. And then it says he was the anointed cherub that covers. What was he covering? Well, I believe it's talking here about how he was hovering over the throne of God, and that he would have been, as the high priest of heaven, leading all of the angels in heaven in worship of God. Now, flip over real quick to Isaiah chapter 6. And Isaiah has a vision of God seated in heaven. And it's very interesting what Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1, he writes, in the year that King Uzziah died, Isaiah talking here, I saw the Lord sitting upon his throne, high and lifted up. His train filled the temple. Above it, so above, he sees God sitting on the throne, and then above God, what does he see? He stood seraphim. So there were two seraphims hovering over the throne of God, and he said each one had six wings. Two covered his face, two covered his feet, and with two they did fly. And they cried to another, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, the whole earth full of his glory. So according to Ezekiel 28, Satan, this anointed cherub, was originally hovering over the throne of God, but after his fall, he is then replaced. We see that in Isaiah chapter 6, he is replaced by two seraphim who are then hovering over the throne of God, leading the angels of God in worship. And he says in verse 15, you were perfect in your ways from the day you were created until iniquity was found in you. And we don't know how long, you know, Satan was in heaven, but eventually he, because of his pride, as Isaiah 14 says, because of his pride, he fell and God put him out of heaven. Verse 16, he says, by the multitude of your merchandise, you have filled the midst of you with violence and you have sinned. Therefore, I will cast you as profane out of the mountain of God, O covering cherub from the midst of the stone. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. And so Satan, this is the describe, you know, the fall of Satan because of his pride and rebellion. He is cast out. And then now look at, let's go to our next slide and let's look at Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3, you know the story that the serpent, who is Satan, comes down. And we learn from Revelation chapter 12 that when Satan fell, one third of the angels followed him in his rebellion against God. Well, then he comes down to earth and he then gets Adam and Eve to join him in his rebellion and their fall. So we have the fall of Adam and Eve and man here in Genesis chapter 3. But what's very interesting, what we'll look at is the curses that God placed on Satan after the fall. And look what he says in verse 15. Here God is speaking to the serpent, who is Satan, and he says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Now, the word bruise there, the way it's translated in the King James, is actually a much stronger word, and it actually means to crush. And the seed there he's talking about is an offspring. And what God is saying here to Satan, he's saying, Satan, someday a woman is going to have a seed, a child, and that child, Satan, is going to crush your head. All right, now, you know, if you get your head bruised, are you dead? No. But if your head is crushed, you're dead. And then God also says, but you shall crush his heel. Now, if you get your foot or your heel crushed, that's very painful, right? But you can recover from that. And this, of course, this was ultimately fulfilled when Jesus died on the cross. It's like his heel was crushed. Okay, it was a very painful death, which he recovered from the third day. He rose from the dead. But in doing so, he crushed the head of Satan. Now look at Genesis 4:1. Adam knew Eve, his wife. She conceived and bore Cain. And she said, I've gotten a man from the Lord. Now we don't know exactly for sure, but the way it reads here, many Bible scholars believe that that Eve more than likely probably thought that this first son she gave birth to was this promised child who was going to crush the head of Satan. Well, of course, her first child, you know, Cain, turns out to be a murderer, you know, and kills his own brother. Now look at Genesis chapter 6. It came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, daughters were born unto them. Let's go to our next slide. The sons of God saw the daughters of men. They were fair. They took them wives of all whom they chose. And then verse 4, there were giants in the earth in those days and also after that. When the sons of God came to the daughters of men, they bore children to them. The same became mighty men who were of old, men of renown. So everywhere you have this phrase, the sons of God, in the Hebrew, it's the B'nai Elohim. It's used 5 times in the Old Testament. And in every single instance, it is talking about angels. We see this in Job chapter 1, where it says, the B'nai Elohim came and appeared to God, came before God. It's talking about angels. Then he says in verse 4 that these angels, they intermarried with human women, and they gave birth to mighty men. And that is the Hebrew word Nephilim, which literally means fallen ones. So what's going on here? Well, I think this was Satan's attempt to corrupt the seed of the woman. He knows, you know, Satan knows there's going to be a child who is going to crush his head. And so what he's going to try to do? He's going to try to stop the coming of that child who is going to crush his head. And the way he does it, he gets his fallen angels to intermarry with human women to corrupt the seed of women to try and stop the coming of that child who is going to crush his head. And we can see this even in the New Testament. 1 Peter, I have the references for you on the slide there, 1 Peter 3:18, but look at 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. If God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell, and that, by the way, is the Greek word tartarus, it's only used here as apparently a special type of hell for these angels that sinned, deliver them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment, and spare not the old world, but save Noah. Peter was talking about there was a group of angels, a number of angels that sinned in the days of Noah, and that sin was so horrific, God has already judged them. He's already put them in Tartarus, a place of darkness. So again, I think this was Satan's attempt to corrupt the seed of the woman and stop the coming of that child. And Genesis chapter 7, verse 1, the Lord said to Noah, you know the story, God tells Noah, you know, build the boat. And Genesis 7, 1, he says, after the boat is built, come you and your house into the ark, for you only have I seen righteous before me in this generation. My friends, it is possible that Noah and his family was the last family left on earth that had not been corrupted in this way. And so now I think you understand maybe a little clearer why God had to wipe the whole earth off, wipe it clean, and start all over again. Now, some people say, wait a minute, didn't Jesus say that angels don't get married, Matthew 22, 30? Well, those are angels in heaven, right? These are fallen angels. And so, and he also mentions, very interesting there in Genesis 6, that when these children were born, they were like giants, and they were able to do mighty things. And we have a lot of archaeology where they've found bones and remains of men who were giants. And it's very possible also that some of our mythology, like of Zeus and Thor and all that, comes from this time of when these giants roamed the earth before the flood. Now, let's go to our next slide. And this, by the way, is the Ark down in Kentucky. How many have been to the Ark in Kentucky? Yeah, it's a really, really neat place. I highly recommend it. Really, it's best to scale. And so let's go to our next slide. Now, it's right after the flood. Look at Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12, that God chooses a man named Abraham. The Lord said unto Abraham, get you out of your country, from your kindred, your father's house, to a land I will show you. I'll make of you a great nation. I'll bless you and make your name great. You shall be a blessing. I'll bless those that bless you and curse those who curse you, and all families of the earth shall be blessed. But then look at verse 7, Genesis 12, 7. The Lord appeared unto Abraham and said, unto your seed will I give this land. So here what God is saying to Abraham is, remember God promised that there was going to be a seed of the woman who was going to crush Satan's head. God is now telling Abraham, through you, Abraham, this seed, this promised child who is going to crush the heaven, Satan's head, is going to come through your offspring, Abraham. And Satan now knows that. And so what is Satan going to try to do? Oh, he's got to try to kill Abraham's offspring, right? So God chooses Abraham, and he sets him apart from the nations of the world. You know the story, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, from the 12 tribes of Israel, and Israel goes down to Egypt, becomes a great nation. And what does Satan inspire Pharaoh to do? He tells him, take every baby boy, throw him into the river. You know, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right? Because remember, Joseph saved the whole land of Egypt from famine. You would think that they'd be very grateful. But no, they ended up, Satan inspires Pharaoh, take all the baby boys, throw them in the Nile River. So again, this is Satan's attempt to stop the coming of that seed, that child who is going to crush his head. And as Israel comes out of Egypt and finally come into their land, there's nations all around them that Satan inspires to destroy them. And when Satan realizes he can't destroy Israel from outside, what does he do? He corrupts them from inside. And Satan gets Israel, you know, Israel falls into idolatry and they begin coming like the nations and they're worshiping all these different gods and idols. And, you know, that becomes so bad. Israel becomes so corrupted that the seed itself is in danger of being corrupted. And so God sends them in captivity to Babylon. And they're in Babylon, they're in Babylon for 70 years. And while they're in captivity, we have the whole story of, remember, the book of Esther. And the Persians come to power. And there's a man named Haman. And Satan inspires Haman to go to the king and destroy not just, remember, Mordecai wouldn't bow down, Mordecai the Jew wouldn't bow down to him. Haman wants to destroy all of the Jews. Now, again, this really makes absolutely no sense until we understand the spiritual battle that's going on behind the scenes. It's Satan, again, it's Satan's attempt to destroy Israel because it is through Israel the Messiah, the seed, is going to come, who is going to crush his head. And you know the whole story of Esther where Haman actually gets hung on his own gallows, a fulfillment of, you know, Genesis 12:3. God says to Abraham, I'll bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. And it's very interesting as you read through the New Testament, or Old Testament rather, that the same way the people, the nations, or somebody curses Israel, it falls back on them. All right, just for example, you know, Pharaoh said, take all the baby boys, throw them into the Nile River. Well, what happens to eventually to Pharaoh and his army? They're drowned in the waters of the Red Sea. Haman has a gallows built 70 feet in the air to hang Mordecai on. What happens? Haman is hung on his own gallows. So we call a curse for a curse of the same kind. You know, folks, you can even see this down to this day because this promise, this covenant that God made with Abraham is still in effect, is still operational today. And where you can really, very interesting to see it in our day and age was with Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. The Nazis hunted down the Jewish people. They imprisoned them in camps. They then put them in gas chambers, mass gas chambers, gassed their bodies to death, took their bodies out of the gas chamber, put them in crematoria, these big ovens, burned their bodies to ashes. Then they took the ashes out and they put them in ponds of water called ash pools. Well, did you know the same thing that the Nazis did to the Jews did to the Nazis after the war? Many of them escaped to South America. And just as the Nazis hunted down the Jews when Israel became a nation, they began hunting down Nazi war criminals. And one guy, they found Adolf Eichmann. Adolf Eichmann was Adolf Hitler's right-hand man. And he escaped to Argentina after the war. He was living incognito down there. The Israelis found him, smuggled him out of the country, took him to Israel, and put him on trial. He was hung by the neck. His body was burned to ashes, and his ashes scattered over the waters of the Mediterranean. A curse for a curse of the same kind. And I tell you what, you want God's blessing on your life, you better bless Israel. God will bless you. Go to our next slide. So finally, Isaiah 7:14, this is 700 years before the time of Jesus. God says, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a child, and you will call his name Emmanuel. There it is again, the seed, that the seed would be born from the nation of Israel and the Jewish people. Go to our next slide. So finally, as Jesus is born, the Virgin Mary, in fulfillment of Isaiah 7:14. And by the way, he has to be born of a virgin because if man is his father, then he's born into sin. He would inherit Adam's sin nature. Because God is his father, that means he is God in the flesh. He does not inherit the sin nature. He is sinless and cannot sin. So Jesus began his ministry, Satan comes to tempt him. And remember, Matthew chapter 4, there are three different temptations. But what I want to focus in on is verse 8 to 9. As Jesus is out in the wilderness, he's fasting, and Satan comes to him, and Satan shows him all of the kingdoms of the world. And Satan says to Jesus, look, if you just bow down and worship me, I will give you those kingdoms. Now, what's kind of interesting is what Jesus does not say. Jesus does not say to Satan, oh, wait a minute, hold on there, Satan. Those aren't your kingdoms. You don't know those kingdoms. No, Jesus did not say that, did he? He acknowledged the fact that Satan owned those kingdoms. And in fact, John 12:31, he said, just before he's crucified, Jesus says, for the time of judging this world has come when Satan, the ruler of this world, will be judged. So how did Satan become the ruler of this world? Well, it's the very first passage, Genesis chapter 3. When God created this world, he gave dominion to this world, to Adam and Eve, to man, to us. When we lost that, when we fell, and Satan became the God and ruler of this world. But then, Jesus, go to our next slide. As Jesus dies on the cross, in atonement, he shed his blood in atonement for sin. His heel was crushed. It was a very painful death. But the third day he arose from the dead, but in dying on the cross for our sin, he paid the price for atonement, paid the price for sin, and in doing so, crush the head of Satan. Satan is now a defeated foe. So if we go to our next slide, although Satan is defeated, there is still one way he can win in his war against God. Let's look at Matthew chapter 23, verse 39. Matthew 23:39. And this is just before Jesus is going to be crucified, and he is overlooking the city of Jerusalem, and he's praying over it. And Jesus said, O Jerusalem, Matthew 23:37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that kills the prophets and stones them, said unto you, how often I would have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, but you would not. Behold, your house, what's their house? That's the temple, is left unto you desolate. And that was fulfilled 70 AD when the Romans destroyed the temple. And he says, I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth till you say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. What Jesus is saying here, he is going to return to heaven, and he's not coming back until Israel, the Jewish people, his people, recognize him as Messiah. And so Satan understands if he can destroy Israel and the Jewish people before they recognize Jesus as Messiah, theoretically, he can stop the return of Jesus. And that's why we are seeing so much anti-Semitism today. This is Satan's war. This is Satan's attempt to try and stop the return of Jesus by destroying Israel and the Jewish people before they accept him as Messiah. Look at Zechariah chapter 13. Zechariah 13 and verse 8. It shall come to pass, and all the land says, the Lord, two parts in it shall be cut off and die, but the third part shall be left in it. And I'll bring the third part through the fire. And what is the fire? That's the seven-year tribulation period. And God is talking here about Israel and the Jewish people. And he says, I will refine them as silver is refined, test them as gold tested. They'll call on my name, and I'll hear them. And I'll say, is my people? And they will say, the Lord is my God. So God is going to use this future seven-year tribulation period as described in the book of Revelation. That's the fire to refine Israel. And he says two-thirds of them are actually going to perish. Think about that. Hitler killed one-third. So there's in the future, this future tribulation, two-thirds will perish. But then he says, I will bring one-third through the fire, through the tribulation. Now there's roughly approximately 15 million Jewish people in the world today. So that means roughly 10 million of them will be killed. One third, about 5 million, will come through the seven-year tribulation. And then look at Romans. Let's look at Romans chapter 11. And Romans chapter 11 God says after they come through the tribulation, they will all then believe. Romans 11:26, Paul writes, "And so all Israel shall be saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob." And this does not mean that every Jewish person who's ever lived is going to be saved. No. This is talking about all the Jewish people who survived the seven-year tribulation period. They will all become believers in Jesus. And we see that in Zechariah 12:10. "And they shall look upon me whom they have pierced." Who's the they? That's Israel. That's at the end of the tribulation period. "And they weep and they mourn for him to return. And he returns in power and glory." And so it's Satan's, and we see that also at the very end of the tribulation in the book of Revelation and other places. At the very end, all of the armies of the world are gathered. Where? To a place called Armageddon. Now, Armageddon is actually from two Hebrew words, Har, meaning mountain, and Megiddo, the mountains of Megiddo. And it's a valley in northern Israel. At the very end of the tribulation, all of the armies are gathered to there. In fact, even the Euphrates River dries up to prepare the way for the kings of the east, so they can also come to the final battle, the Battle of Armageddon. Now, it really should be called, folks, it really should be called the Battle for Jerusalem. Because while the armies of the Antichrist are gathered there, why are they gathered there? To attack Jerusalem. And it's, again, Satan's attempt to destroy Israel and the Jewish people before they believe in Jesus, so he can try to stop the coming of Jesus. And Zechariah 14:2 says, "The city shall be taken." It's amazing. The Antichrist and his armies, in the beginning of that battle, they're successful. They capture the city of Jerusalem. And then when it looks like all hope is lost, Jesus will return in power and glory to save Israel. Look at Isaiah chapter 63. Isaiah 63, just one of my favorite chapters. Very few Christians, I think, are really aware that this passage is about the second coming of Christ at the end of the seven-year tribulation. Isaiah chapter 63. "Who is this that comes from Edom with dyed garments from Bozra?" Now, you probably don't know where Bozra is. You know where Edom is. Okay, Edom today is the modern country of Jordan, but it's southern Jordan. Bozra is the Aramaic name, and you know it better as Petra. And Isaiah gets a vision here of Jesus, and he's coming from Bozra. He says, "Glorious in your apparel, traveling in the greatness of your strength." And who is it? God says, "It's I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save." This is talking about the second coming of Christ. And he asks him in verse 2, "Why are you red in your apparel and your garments like him who treads the wine vat?" Now, we know in Revelation chapter 19, when Jesus returns, what color is the garment he's wearing? What color is the robe he's wearing? It's white, right? But here he says, "Why is your garment like one who treads the wine vat?" Now, back in the old days, you know, when they tread the wine vat, you know, one time when I was in Israel, we went to a biblical garden, and they showed us, very, very fascinating. When they would tread the wine vat with the grapes, they would take their robe and they would pull it up around their waist. And as they're treading the grapes, of course, the juice from the grapes is going to splatter up on their robe. And as Isaiah sees Jesus coming from Bozra, he sees that his robe that was white is being splattered, not with the blood of grapes, the blood of men. He is trampling down the armies of the Antichrist from Bozra all the way up to Jerusalem. Now, why does he come to Bozra first, Petra? That's where the Jewish people will be hiding out from the armies of the Antichrist for the second half of the tribulation period. And he says in verse 3, "I've trodden the winepress alone, and the peoples, there was none with me. I will tread them in my anger, trample them in my fury. their blood shall sprinkle upon my garments, and I will stain my raiment. For the day of vengeance is my heart, the year of my redeemed has come. So Jesus, as he returns, he saves Israel. Zechariah 12:10, they see him, the nail in his hands and his feet. They call for his return. He returns in power and glory, and he begins trampling the armies of the Antichrist from Petra, southern Jordan, Basra, all the way up to Jerusalem. And in Zechariah 14, it says, when his feet touch the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem, it splits in two. And he will then, at that point, after he's defeated the armies of the Antichrist, separate the sheep from the goats. And the sheep, the believers, enter into the millennium. And he's going to set up his kingdom and rule the world for 1,000 years. Now look at Revelation chapter 7, because there's one more reason, another reason why Satan hates Israel. And we see it in Revelation chapter 7. It's because Israel is going to lead, and the Jewish people will lead, what I believe is going to be the greatest revival in the history of the world. Because, you know, I believe very firmly, I'm sure, I hope many of you do also, that we as the church, we as believers in Jesus, we are going to be removed from this earth before the start of the tribulation period, what's called the rapture of the church. So who's going to be here and witness? Who's going to be God's witnesses? Well, we read it right here in Revelation 7. It's going to be 144,000 Jewish people. Revelation 7:3 says, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. Now in chapter 6, he talks about how 1/4 of the people in the world are killed through war, famine, and pestilence. Folks, of a world population today of around 8 billion, 1/4 of that, that's around 2 billion people will be killed in just the first part of the tribulation period. But he says before that happens, he sees 144,000. These people are sealed for protection. They're sealed for service. And then verse 4, he says, I heard the number of them which were sealed, and they were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. Tribe of Judah, 12,000. Reuben, Gad, Asher, etc. He lists the 12 tribes of Israel. They are sealed for service. They will be God's witnesses after the church is removed. And look at verse 9. After he sees the 144,000, he says, after this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude which no man could number, of all nations, kindreds, and peoples, and tongues, stood before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed in white robes. Who are they? Verse 14, Revelation 7:14. These are they who came out of the great tribulation, washed their robes, made them white in the blood of the Lamb. So after he sees the 144,000, they are God's witnesses during the tribulation, then he sees this vast multitude of Gentiles, not Jewish people, Gentiles from all around the world, and they have come to faith in Jesus. And how they do it is through the witness of the 144,000 Jewish evangelists. And that's another reason Satan hates them, because they are going to lead, probably, this is probably the, I think, the biggest revival in the history of the world, where upwards of 1 billion people have come to faith from all around the world in the tribulation period. So as we're seeing this intense hatred and rise of persecution, anti-Semitism today, I want to say in the morning, you want to have God's blessing on you? Bless Israel. God still has a wonderful plan for them. And Father, as we see the world in turmoil and we see you're working among your people, we say, even so, come, Lord Jesus, and help us to be living, watching, waiting, working for you. In your name we pray. Amen.